This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book and to find out the story behind the book. So I am so thrilled today that I have two of my absolute favorite guests. They are a duo. They are the most one of the most beautiful couples I've ever seen, except when I look at my husband and myself. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, because they were here, well, they've been here many times, and they were here for the fourth anniversary. And today we are celebrating the fifth anniversary of Joy on Paper with Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant. Hi.
Hi, Patsy.
Wow, this is a thrill. Well, I get both of you, or should I say three of you? I'm not sure now what to do. What to do there about you, Andrew?
Exactly. Well, I'll try to just be I'll try to just be one person for today. But let me just say, what an absolute pleasure it is to be back on the show, Patsy, especially on this significant anniversary. So thank you so much for inviting us and having us as your guests once again. We really appreciate it.
We do.
Well, you know, you were here for your most recent books. Back in January, we were talking about Tasha, of course, your wonderful, wonderful Lady Emily mystery series, a historical mystery series, which is just my cup of tea, literally. And I just so happy that you know, when we were talking then, I got this idea for a hat and tea party with Lady Emily. And I was going to announce it today. But unfortunately, with the current conditions, we've decided to postpone it from April, and we'll put it sometime in August. But we're going to have a party in honor of Lady Emily, because I have there are so many of your fans here in our area at our library clubs and at reading groups, and we're going to all wear fancy hats, and I'm going to sponsor proper British tea, and I'm going to make it with boiling water. I mean, really.
Oh, that's excellent. It's very hard to get a good cup of tea here.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, if I'm going to have a tea party, I have lots of teapots, a collection of teapots, and I'm going to pull them all out, and in honor of Lady Emily and you, we're going to have a really proper party, okay?
That is just so lovely, and I love the idea of the hats as well.
Yeah, I thought that would make it really decorative, and we might even get some local press coverage that way. You know, we'll make it really, really a fun event, and we'll probably I will give out door prizes, but we'll probably also raise some money for our local library here. So that's one of the things, my goal. So it's going to be lots of fun.
Wonderful.
And, of course, last time we were here, we were talking about Shadow of Vesuvius, which is, you know, your most recent book. I'm sure you're working on a new one.
I am.
Always. And, well, everybody knows Andrew Grant, you know, when I first saw you, the minute I saw you, you were on a panel here at BoucherCon, here at the beautiful Vinoy Hotel, and there you are sitting, and of course Tasha is looking at you with this absolute glow on her face. Whenever she looks at you, she's like, you know, so she's so in love. You can just see it, and it's very funny. You get a lot of times you have couples on these panels and stuff, and they just look ahead. They, you know, they sort of ignore their spouses, but with you guys, Tasha is just like looking at you like she's never seen you before. Like, oh, isn't he just so gorgeous?
Well, he is.
He is. But I mean, you know, I will tell you, most of the couples that I see on these panels, they act, you know, very stoic. And as a matter of fact, they don't show any affection to each other. And there's Tasha she's just looking at you like, oh, well, I can't keep my eyes off of him. And the minute I saw you, I said, oh, he looks like Drew. He in my head, when I talk about you, you're always Drew to me. So so if I slip into that, you don't mind. But of course, now I can skip into some, you know, here we were in January talking about your second, your second book in your new series. And whoa, unbeknownst to me, you guys were already working on something really, really dramatic. Do you want to explain to my listeners, because they know about it, but they'd love to hear a little bit about this story of why you are now a second person?
Exactly. Absolutely, and I'm so happy that we're able to talk about it now, because I felt bad when we were talking about Too Close to Home, and that I knew there was this news bubbling in the background, but we were sworn to secrecy, so we couldn't say anything. But funnily enough, that image that you mentioned, when Tasha and I and my brother did the panel together in St. Petersburg, because he was there talking about his Jack Reacher books. And the big news was that after writing 24 of them, he has decided that it's time for him to retire. So he is going to be stepping back a little bit, and we've agreed that the next two or three we're going to work on together, and then he's going to retire altogether, and I'm going to take over the Jack Reacher mantle. So the book I'm working on at the moment isn't a Paul McGrath book. In fact, it's a Jack Reacher book, and it's within probably 2 weeks of being finished.
Wow.
So it's an exciting time. It's been an interesting experience for me, because I wrote 9 books trying desperately not to sound like my brother, and now I've got to sound like him.
Exactly. It's so funny, because just like last year, I asked my listeners for questions for you guys. So I have some interesting questions, and a couple were about how you decided to use another name. You're going to be Andrew Child for the new books.
That's right. Yeah, and actually there was a lot of misinformation about this when the story broke, because the publishers wanted to keep it under wraps a little bit longer, and they were planning on making a sort of proper formal announcement later, but not really quite sure what happened. But the journalist in London found out about it, and it ended up getting in the newspapers. And one of the things that the newspapers said was that my brother had made it a condition of this new arrangement that I changed my name, and that's completely not true. What happened was that we were thinking about how to best kind of position this transition, because what a lot of people have done over the years is actually they've kind of secretly introduced a second writer that's worked alongside the person that's named, and my brother never would do that. He refused to do anything like that. He said that if at any time he decided to step aside and have somebody else working with him, then that would be up front, center, everybody would know about it. So the original idea was that it would be my regular name, Andrew Grant. But somebody suggested that the best thing to do the thing that's really unique about this situation, there's been plenty of times when authors have worked with other authors, or even after they've died, the estate has brought in somebody different to come and do it. The difference here is that this is two brothers doing it, and it was the original brother's choice to do it this way. And so to sort of emphasize that family connection and to say to people, listen, Jack Reacher's in safe hands, because, I was the first Jack Reacher fan in the world. I was the first person to read Killing Floor. I was, I was out there, when no one knew who Lee Child was, telling everybody, buy this book, it's brilliant. And, I get Jack Reacher. One of the funny things about Killing Floor, the first Jack Reacher book, is that, and there's been stories about this in the press, when he started writing it, he hadn't decided on the character's name. And because it was written in the first person, and as people will know, Jack Reacher often says nothing, it was quite a long way into the book. He'd already been arrested, he was in the police station, he was refusing to say anything. It was quite a long way into the book before he revealed his name, and that was partly because my brother hadn't thought of it yet. And so when I was reading that book for the first time, I was terrified, because my brother had lost his job, everything was at stake, he had to make this thing a success. And I'm reading it and I'm thinking, I love thrillers, I read them all the time, I was pretty well versed in the genre, and I'm thinking, God, what if I read this this book and I hate it. You know, what if it's terrible? And so I'm reading it, I'm loving it. And even now, I don't know the character's name yet, because you have to read quite a long way into the book before you find that out. I knew that character. I understood him. I knew exactly who he was, what he was about, how he thought, what his values were, you know, how he would respond to different situations. And that's because my brother and I are so similar in so many ways, you know. He was channeling this part of his psyche, and it spoke directly to mine. So, you know, I'm just overwhelmed that he would give me this opportunity, but I'm so excited by it and just cannot wait.
Well, it is wonderful, and yes, you're right. The journalist made it sound like Big Brother really acted like a big brother, nasty little brother. And I had a feeling that was not true.
But no, yeah, it wasn't. You were right, Percy. That wasn't true.
You know, and although, as you know, I was a big sister, and people might say that I did boss my brother around a little bit, and he would be the first one to say that, yes, I was a little bossy, but I didn't think that your brother forced you.
No.
It was. Oh well, you know, that's the press for you. So we have to get things straight, and that's why we're here, because it's so funny. I have questions from my listeners for both of you, and I was so amused by some of them because I had never even thought about. And I'll do the first one for you because it relates to you and your brother. How tall are you?
We are both 6 foot four.
Both 6 foot four. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Which is interesting because he made Jack Reacher 6 foot five.
Yes.
Which is just a sort of very subtle, you know, that's the way his brain works. You know, it's just a sort of subtle clue that, you know, this isn't him. This is like a magnified version, you know. So it's just, you know, giving him that extra, giving Reacher that extra inch just symbolizes that.
Yes. So that's now, everybody knows now that you're both the same size and you're both equally talented, I will say that for sure. And it is funny that in your books, where you tend to be a little bit wittier than, let's say, Jack Reacher, it's fun to think of you now putting on this different hat here and getting into the whole book. And we'll talk about that in a minute, because that's one of the questions that people have asked. But for Tasha, you know, as I said, I have some ladies' clubs here and organizations, and they love your books. And, of course, everyone knows, anyone who reads your books, that Lady Emily, her first dance with Colin was a waltz.
Yeah.
So one of my listeners wants to know, do you and Drew waltz?
Well, you know, we never have, but I would really like us to. My dream is to someday that we could learn the Viennese waltz, because the Viennese waltz is much faster than the regular waltz. And it was so scandalous when it first came into existence in the 19th century that there were many people in Britain who felt that it should be banned, because, you know, you have to hold your partner quite close so that you don't, you know, go flying around the ballroom. So I would love us to learn the Viennese waltz and then go to a New Year's ball in Vienna and dance it.
Oh, yes. And you could get in. You could get into the big ones. You'd be on television. My goodness. They would love it. Boy, oh, boy. The ratings would go up if the two of you would do the waltz. And it is so beautiful.
It is.
And, of course, Vienna is magical. I just love Vienna. I spent a lot of time there. And so, you know, that was an interesting question. I had never thought about it, but yeah.
That's a great question.
By the way, do you remember your first dance?
Yes, I do. My first dance, I was in my grade school, and a boy who was a very good friend of mine, Jonathan Rosenberg, he asked me to dance, and the song was The Heat of the Moment by Asia.
Well, see? That's
See? Dancing. You remember these things. That,
you do. You do remember these things. That's fantastic. I love it. Now, here's one for Drew. What was your first car? Not a Mini Morris, we assume.
Well, I've got to say, your listeners have the best questions. It's always such fun, you know, wondering what's gonna come up. My first car was a metallic green Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh,
that I bought in about 1986, I believe. it was pretty much at the end of its life, unfortunately. And I adopted, because, you know, Volkswagen Beetles are brilliant cars because they're very, very simple. There's not too much on there that's unnecessary. So my policy, what would happen is that every now and again I'd be driving along and it'd be making a weird noise, and a piece of it would fall off. So what I would do is I'd scoop up whatever had fallen off, and at first I'd be very worried about this, but what I ended up doing was putting the piece that fell off in the boot, as we called it, which is in the front with Beetles. And my policy was that if its performance didn't noticeably change in 7 days, then the piece that fell off probably wasn't very important, so I never had it put back on. So the car had substantially fewer pieces by the time I eventually sold it, but it was still moving. But because of that car, you know, even to this day, you know, you get the thing in a lot of cars now where, for economy, if you stop at traffic lights or at a junction, the engine cuts out and doesn't come back on again until you're ready to move. Well, I hate that, because my Volkswagen, it would pretty much always conk out if you had to stop. And then you had this horrible sinking feeling, you know, will I ever be able to get this car started again? Or will everybody in the line behind me be honking, you know? So even today, if I'm in one of those cars with one of those economy features and the engine cuts out, even though it's supposed to, my heart still sinks.
It's funny, my first car was also green. It was a Rambler, an American car, a terrible car too. American Motors. They went out of business. I don't know why. but it was green. I always have colorful cars. I like to be able to see that car. I don't like just a car that blends in. So I've always gone for really powerful colors. So, yeah. Wow. It's hard to imagine you at 6'4" in a Beetle, but that's, you know, it's fun. One of the questions that, you know, for, again, back to Lady Emily, she has a lot of things that you brought into these stories. And one of them is that Lady Emily drinks port.
Yes.
And tell us why. I know why, but.
Well, you know, I actually think of, full credit where credit is due. My ex-husband, his father, had taken us, this was when I was writing the first book, I had written maybe the first chapter or so, had taken us out to dinner, and we were at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Connecticut, and he said after dinner, he said, well, if you're writing a book about Victorians, we should have a glass of port.
Uh-huh.
And I had never had port before then, and I tasted it and I loved it. And the thing with port is, it's in the 19th century, when you had such repressive restrictions on women in society, port kind of became a thing that was only for men. After dinner, the ladies would retire to the drawing room, and where they could have sherry or coffee. And the men would stay in the dining room with port and cigars. And they basically held off all of the interesting conversation for the evening until the ladies had left. And so after I tasted that port, I thought, you know, this is too good for Emily not to drink. And anyway, she's inherited all of her late husband's possessions, including the port. So she thinks, why should she not drink her own port, right? And it's the sort of thing that to us in contemporary society maybe sounds a little silly. Well, why can't you drink whatever you want that's in the cellar in your own house? But for a woman in 1890,
risque.
I'm not getting up from the table. I'm staying here and drinking the port. That is a woman inserting herself into the important conversation of the day, be it political, be it religious, be it whatever it is, she is saying, I have a voice at this table. And so, and of course, that is utterly scandalizing to her friends and especially her mother in society. It simply should not be done. But, you know, those little steps, it seems like a little step to us, but to someone in that time, that would have been an enormous social faux pas.
And, of course, Lady Emily leads us in many, many, throughout the books, into new areas of women's emancipation.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, the thing is, that's one of the things that I have so enjoyed with writing the series, because when I first started, I really wanted to explore that idea of what would catalyze a woman, a young woman in Emily's situation, someone who has all the money she could ever want. She gets, even though it's a restrictive society, because of her rank, her father is an earl, and the fortune that she's been left by her late husband, she has more flexibility in terms. She gets a little more tolerance out of society than someone of a lower rank would. But she still is stuck in the society. What makes a person who has pretty much she can do whatever she wants within reason, but I wanted her to look at the world in a broader way, to see that not everyone was in her situation. You know, the economy and society in Victorian Britain was really, you know, the upper class and the lower class were so far apart that, you know, you have children working in factories dying of hideous, hideous diseases at the same time that you have the upper class, you know, going to balls and parties every night during the season where, you know, more is spent on champagne than would feed, house, and clothe hundreds of families. But in that day and age, most of the upper class wasn't paying attention to that. So I wanted to really think about how a woman who's in a comfortable situation, despite the restrictions of society, would start looking at the bigger picture and saying, hey, hang on, this is not okay. And women's rights and the suffragette movement is, of course, a huge piece of that.
And that's why we love Lady Emily. I think all the ladies that, you know, I talk to, and as I said, some of them, you know, at the clubs when we're talking about books to read, and I always bring up your books anyway, but it is exactly that. They admire that Lady Emily is out there making these demands, making these changes in society. So it's just a wonderful series. Everybody, there are so, how many books now? It's up to?
14.
14 books. And one of the listeners said your books are like travel guides, because before she went to Greece, to Athens, she was making a tour of Athens and that area. And so she, you know, she read one of your books. Well, she had actually read, which book is it? The St. Petersburg one before she went to Russia.
Yeah.
And but you're such a great historian, and you tell, you know, you make the history so interesting. And this is, that's why I think you have so many wonderful fans, because you really take them to these places. And right now, I'm telling everyone, right now you cannot travel to all these places, except if you pick up all of Tasha Alexander's books. You can start from the beginning. You got 14 books, because she takes you to all these wonderful places in Europe, and your description, and you take us right into it, you know, and particularly restaurants. And I'm coming back to that question, because I have a couple of questions people want to know about restaurants. But first, Drew, do you guys play board games, and do you have a collection of chess sets like Colin does in the Lady Emily series?
Well, we don't really play board games very much, actually. But Tasha does have a very nice chess set in her office, so I guess we can claim half credit on that question.
Okay, well, maybe you should start collecting them.
I love chess sets so much, and when I was young, I played a lot of chess. And, you know, I have to kind of rein myself in, because since we don't have both a London townhouse and an enormous country estate, you know, we don't have space for the hundreds of chess sets I would like to have. They're so beautiful. I mean, they're just beautiful as objects. And the one in my office is actually, it was a gift from a dear friend, and it's a reproduction of the Lewis chess set, the medieval chess pieces that are in the British Museum.
Well, maybe Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant don't have a London townhouse, but now Andrew Child probably going to get buy a big one over there. There's some great ones there.
There always used to be, for years, there was a huge house. It was amazing, given the location. It was right on Piccadilly. I think it had been owned by Lord Palmerston, who was Prime Minister at one point. And it was derelict. It was vacant. And I think it's been bought now and probably turned into a hotel or something. But for years, you know, we would walk by it and think, goodness, how can a house like that in this place be basically available? But, you know, unfortunately, too late.
Too late. Well, there are some more there. I would get one not too far from Harrods myself. So. I love that Hans Crescent right there behind Harrods. I know it
well. Yeah.
And I used to park, you know, I told you that in England I had a white Cadillac.
Uh-huh.
Did I tell you that? I had a white, yeah, and I used to park it there in Hans Crescent right behind Harrods, which was lots of fun. Now, Drew, this is a great question for you. If you could invite any spy from the past to the pub for a beer, which spy would you invite? Who would you like to talk to?
Which spy? Sorry, I thought you said...
Okay. You know, from the past. I mean, it could be Victorian, it can be, you know, 50, it can be... Which spy would you want to sit down over a beer and talk about a little bit of the spy trade?
Well, I think I would have to say Kim Philby, because, first of all, he's pretty much recognized as being, you know, the most successful and audacious spy of all time. And secondly, I think what's so interesting about him is, you know, I've read lots of books about lots of different spies and, you know, to find out about spycraft and, you know, find out all the things that are involved. And what you discover with particularly in wartime, the majority of spies are not ideological. The majority of them are doing it either because they see an opportunity to make money, so they're mercenary, or because they've been compromised in some way and they're forced into doing what they're doing in order to protect themselves or their families. There are some amazing stories about the spying that went on during World War II, for example. But I think what makes Philby such an interesting character is that he wasn't doing it for money. You know, he came from a comfortable background, so he didn't need the cash. He was doing it, and of course, you know, the vast majority of people, particularly in the West, are going to disagree with his motive. But the thing is, he genuinely and sincerely believed in what he was doing. He thought that, you know, what other people saw as betrayal, he saw as working for a better society for everyone. And I think the opportunity to talk about, well, what would it be like to do something that you passionately believe in, even though pretty much everyone else you've ever come in contact with would see that as just the most grotesque betrayal of everything that they believe in. I think that would be a fascinating conversation.
It would. And of course, I was going to say, if you had picked Mata Hari, then you'd have had to have champagne at the Ritz Hotel. Because I don't think...
Well, you know, I'm never averse to champagne at the Ritz. So.
Yeah, because I don't think she'd want the beer in the pub. Which reminds me, I did want to ask, now that you live in America and in a wonderful area of the country, do you like your beer cold or do you still like it warm?
Well, you know... I like a lot of different beers. I do like cold beer. It depends on the kind of beer that you're talking about, because there are some, particularly the ones, you know, I lived in Yorkshire for a long time, and there were some amazing breweries there that made that real old school northern bitter that I still like, and you wouldn't really want that cold. But at the same time, especially when we were in Chicago, there were all kinds of lovely microbreweries everywhere, and you could get an amazing selection. So I tend to like IPAs best. I think that would be my favorite. If I had to pick one kind, that's generally what I gravitate towards.
And speaking of beer and pubs, what's your favorite pub in England?
Oh, now that's a difficult one. No, the thing is that, you know, I went to school, as we've talked about before, Patsy, I went to school in St. Albans in Hertfordshire, and St. Albans had the most incredible array of pubs because, for some reason, there were more at the time. I don't know if it's still the case, but they said that there were more pubs per head of population in St. Albans than anywhere else, certainly in the UK, maybe anywhere. And it was where there was an organization called CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale, which was a kind of precursor to the microbrewery movement. It was the idea that people wanted to get away from the sort of mass-produced, characterless, kind of, you know, pretend lagers and move to beer that was brewed in small batches and had real character and real flavor. And that really took hold in St. Albans. And there were numerous pubs there that I used to enjoy going to. There was a street called Fishpool Street, which is a lovely old-fashioned English name. That was where the back entrance to my school was. So we would sneak out at lunchtime and go to the pub and meet girls. And there were several pubs down there. There was the Lower Red Lion that was great. There was the Six Bells, I remember. But one pub in particular that I really liked was called the Fighting Cocks, and that was the one, Patsy, that you found that postcard of. And that was heading in the opposite direction from the, that was, you'd have to come out of the main entrance to the school and go about 300 yards down, and it was on the edge of a lake in Verulamium Park. So you know, any one of those pubs I would certainly love to go back to and relive some old memories.
And they had some tables outside in the nice weather, and
there's something about an English beer garden that that is really hard to beat. There was one when I worked for the phone company. There was an engineering training school in Staffordshire that we had to go to sometimes, and if you weren't really supposed to leave, but if you escaped and walked down to the town, there was a pub that was right on the canal, and you could sit outside and enjoy a nice beer and watch. And what was particularly fun about it was that the canal itself is only used by pleasure craft now rather than being industrial, but the locks still work. And so I think pretty much every time I went there, there'd be some 18, 19-year-olds, because, you know, the drinking age is 18 in England, who would drink too much beer and then decide that rather than walk the 4 or 5 miles around via the bridge to get to the other side of the canal, they would just walk across the lock gates. And you can imagine the way that ended for pretty much all of them. So that was a little bit of extra, you know, unpaid.
A little show for you.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, speaking of inebriation and drinking, in one of your books, Tasha, you talk about champagne and Moët Chandon. What did you actually go there?
I have been there. Andrew and I were there, probably maybe like 8 years ago now.
I think so.
I think it was. But I've always, my parents were always very, very big on champagne. And so they would, you know, they didn't have a lot of money when we were growing up, but, you know, they would save up once in a while, buy a bottle of champagne, and have a champagne party where my mom would make all these hors d'oeuvres, and they'd have the bottle of champagne. So that was always part of kind of my family. It was just one of our rituals, you know, when that could happen, be it New Year's Eve or you know, their anniversary or whatever. And Moët is a wonderful champagne house. And, of course, their top champagne is Dom Pérignon, which is named after the blind monk who supposedly, legend says, tasted the first champagne and said it was like drinking the stars. And unfortunately, Emily and Colin can't drink Dom because Moët hadn't started making it yet in their time. So that there are a few references throughout the books where they'll sort of say, oh, maybe someday they should have something, you know, it's always me trying to, you know, and if I'm fortunate enough to keep writing the books long enough, maybe I can get them up to when Dom started being produced.
We'll yeah, I think you will. Well, of course, your books have lots of references to food, but I had one very interesting question. Do you prefer peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, or do you like this new Vegemite or Marmite sandwich that they serve in England?
I think I'd have to go with peanut butter and jelly on that.
Yeah. I think so too. Drew, have you gotten used to peanut butter and jelly, or do you ever do it?
No, I think it's one of those things. Maybe if you grow up with it, it would seem normal. But for me, it just seems just completely unimaginable to combine those flavors. So I've never tried it. I can't imagine.
But
I
you
ever
also
will.
Don't like nuts.
I don't like nuts very much. I'm not allergic to them or anything, but I'm just not. I just don't really like them. So, but on the other hand, I'm one of those people who really does like Marmite. You know, I love it. And some people, it's one of those classic things where some people love it and some people hate it. And I think it's fabulous. I love Marmite. And I love getting a real good, strong English cheddar and making a sandwich with that and some Marmite. That would be my favorite.
That is a very special and acquired taste. And it's funny. It's like when I lived in Iran, I bought, peanut butter, and I would make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, for like hors d'oeuvres type of thing. And people would like, what is? But, exactly when we grew up with it. And so, in your books, Tasha, you always describe, sometimes the books make you very hungry. You describe some of the foods that you describe. And so one of the questions that a listener asks is, do you go to like all these restaurants and try all of these fancy foods that you mention in your books? And
I do try to. Obviously, some of the restaurants that Emily could have gone to are no longer open. But for example, there was one in The Adventurous that is a restaurant in Cannes. We did go eat at because it's been there since the 19th century, still in existence. The other thing I like to do is cook. So, like when I was writing Fatal Waltz, I spent a very long months and months and months cooking baking Viennese pastries, making Wiener Schnitzel. I learned how to make homemade Spätzle. Because you mentioned before the travel aspect to the books, and I think that was something that from the beginning was really important to me, because as a reader from the time I was very young, books were a way to travel for me. So I want to make sure that I'm giving my readers that full immersive experience, and food is such a significant piece of every culture. When I was doing A Terrible Beauty, I was making Greek food all the time. I mean, it's really fun, actually, because you expand your repertoire of cooking enormously, and it's really fascinating to learn about other cultures' food.
Oh, the Greek food that you described, that really got me. I love that one. So, one of the things and one of the other questions was, do you get a kick out of the fact that all of your travel and eating in fancy restaurants is tax deductible because you're doing research?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a nice perk.
Isn't it?
It absolutely is. Although I'm not sure. I mean, Andrew and my son, who've both been on lots of research trips with me, would probably argue that fun might not be the way to describe them, because, I mean, they are fun, but it's work. It's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work. But, I'm a bit of a taskmaster, and I have a very packed itinerary of things that I need to see and places. And I also insist on walking everywhere, because you don't get to know a city by taking the tube or going on the metro. You've got to walk the streets. You've got to see the people. You've got to. So it can be a rather exhausting trip, but wonderful nonetheless.
Well, and here's a funny question from one of my listeners. Andrew, what is Tasha's favorite color?
Well, that is one, unfortunately, I can't answer. And her favorite color is blue.
And I don't know why somebody wanted to know that. They just thought that was something that, they wanted to know about Tasha, what her favorite color is. And so, do you wear a lot of blue?
Well, blue is definitely my favorite.
and of course, it's funny how, we'll ask them, what is Andrew's favorite color?
Yellow.
See?
Yeah, in fact, you were talking about bright colored cars. We have a car that is probably the brightest color of yellow that you could ever see.
So, a Hummer?
It's actually because, you know, we live 10 miles off the paved road, and we live in, you know, there's tons of snow and mud and gravel and everything. So we need to, you know, we need cars that can handle it. So I have, it's 13 years old now, but it's a Toyota FJ Cruiser in bright yellow.
Oh, I had a Hummer, a yellow mm-hmm. Hummer. And I loved it, and I'm so sorry that I let it go. But that was at the time when the petrol prices kept going up and up and up and up.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, it was horrible on the petrol. But I miss that car because I loved it. I just, there I am in that yellow car, and everybody's looking at me. I like it. I love a yellow car.
So. Yeah, well, it's great. I love the color. You can go anywhere in it. You can put the kayaks on the roof. You can put the skis in the back. You know, it's just great. It's fun and practical at the same time, which is what I really like.
Well, another question about back to Jack Reacher, and people want to know, you know, your books generally are not as, let's say, violent. Jack Reacher tends to always get into a real violent mess around him. Are you finding that challenging?
I mean, it's one of the things that I've had to adjust to, definitely. But it doesn't feel totally alien to me because, in a sense, I one of the reasons that I steered clear from there being as much violence in my books was that I wanted them to be different from my brother's books. So it wasn't that it had never occurred to me, or that I'd never thought about it, or that it wouldn't have really fit in the stories if I'd chosen to take them in a different direction. But I just didn't want my books to be clones of his. So for example, with the janitor books, you know, the janitor comes across a number of, you know, completely obnoxious characters, but and I could easily have had the, you know, added a few inches to his height and a few pounds and had him just beat the guys up. But what I wanted to do with the janitor was have him bring, you know, force these horrible characters to have their comeuppances, but to do it through more kind of trickery and more, you know, outwitting them, which, you know, Reacher is an interesting character because he is very cerebral. You know, he spends a lot of his time either contemplating things or figuring out puzzles in his head. So he does do an awful lot of thinking, and he's obsessed with trivia. And, you know, he has a real pedantic streak in him, which often leads him onto, you know, weird sort of streams of thought. You know, there was, I forget which book it was now, but there was one, and this, again, this is quite reflective of my brother's way of thinking, which is that, you know, everybody's heard of a spiral staircase, right? Everybody's seen them. Most people have probably been up them at some time, but of course, actually, that's the wrong way to describe them, because as a spiral is a two-dimensional shape. You know, those staircases are actually helixes, not spirals. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, Reacher, and you know, on the one hand, he's going down these mental rabbit holes about the most, you know, arcane detail, and then the next page is, you know, he's pummeling some some thug.
Definitely pummeling somebody. And yeah. I thought it was amusing, since I always think of you as an old Albanian, that his most recent book was included Albanians. And I said to myself, oh, I don't know. I was always thinking about, when I think about you, I think of old Albanians. So maybe somehow some of my brain waves went to your brother. And so he, in the most recent book, and of course, I'm best-selling book, Blue Moon, he has Albanians. And so I said, okay, he got some of my brain waves.
Absolutely. I think you must have influenced him. And talking about Blue Moon, when the paperback of Blue Moon comes out, it's going to have the first chapter of the new collaborative Reacher in the back. So
okay.
If anybody is interested in a sneak peek of what we've been working on together, it will be available in the back of Blue Moon.
Just when it comes out, maybe the two of you would like to come on together. And
oh, I'm sure we would. We would love it, yeah.
Whoa, that would be really breaking news for me. So, look, I want to thank you so much for being part of this really joyous day for me, the fifth anniversary of Joy on Paper, a program that I created so that I could help promote authors and their books and encourage people to read more. And now, I'm telling you, all of you people at home, you have a lot of books here to read. Tasha, you just start with Tasha right from the beginning. You go right through and have a travel all over Europe with Tasha. And with Andrew Grant, you have just wonderful, a wide variety, but the new series, the Janitor series, we'll call it, but it's really wonderful, and you can start with those. There's two books in that series, and I want to thank you so much for being part of this with me today.
Well, Patsy, thank you for having us. We always, always adore getting to talk to you, and your listeners are so wonderful and have such fascinating, wonderful questions. It's just a delight to be here.
Okay. It is, and also, you know, the fact that this is the fifth anniversary, you know, this is a real opportunity, a real moment to celebrate, because, you know, this wouldn't exist without you, and it's fun, and it's enormously helpful. It's so supportive for authors and for people who are working to become authors. So, you know, the work that you do, it's enjoyable, but it's also really useful. So thank you for everything you do, Patsy. We appreciate it.
We do, and it's a wonderful milestone, and I hope that you have some champagne in your future today.
I actually do. So thank you very much, and I will be thinking of you, and you will both be on soon, I know for sure, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well now, you know, one of the wonderful things that happened to me through this program was that I gained a goddaughter, and I am so happy that Kanisha Price is going to talk to us today. Hi, Kanisha.
Good morning, Godmother Patsy.
Oh,
hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm so happy to talk to you, Kanisha. I want to tell everybody that when I was doing this program, I'd been doing it for 4 or 5 months, and I was invited to speak at a library group, and I was terrified because I was okay. I was all right. I was getting pretty good. I could sit here in the studio and talk and have a few guests, and I always have Big Ed across from me, and he keeps me calm. And I was really nervous when I did that, you know, I was invited to do this speech, until I saw you. I want everybody to know that I saw Kanisha. She came in late she came in right towards the end, and I'm up at the front shaking. I was so scared. I didn't know if I could talk. And there she comes in, and she has this big smile on her face. And when you talk about a million-dollar smile, Kanisha has a million-dollar smile. And I want to thank you. I'm so grateful for all the time that you've given me, all the joy that you've given me and my family. And we love you, and we're so very proud, I think, of all the things that have happened here on Joy on Paper. Finding you is the most significant.
That means a lot to me. That is an honor to be a part of your family. Your family is wonderful and has inspired me in so many ways. Of course, writing, reading more, and I've even gone back to school for engineering. So, I was late that day coming from work because I work in Tampa and I live in Pinellas. But now with school, oh my goodness, actually going back to school to be an electrical engineer. Your son is a biomedical engineer. Your family has inspired me in so many ways. So I do look forward to taking physics, because I believe it's really going to give me that edge in sci-fi writing. So I actually told my physics advisor that. So I'm really excited about that course.
Because you've done how many NaNoWriMos? Two?
Four.
Four?
Yeah, there were three NaNoWriMos, and then my first book was outside of NaNoWriMo. So yeah, I've done three.
And
I've done three.
I know that one day we're going to see your books published, because you're a very talented author, and it's great that you're getting your education and building up all of your pension. So one day when you're ready to just turn to writing full time, you're all set for it, because you're very talented. And Kanisha, I want to thank you for calling in today, and I want also to send our love to your mother, who's just so beautiful. When I saw her, the first time I saw your mother, I said, my gosh, she looks like a queen. She is so regal and so beautiful. So I want to say thank you to her for having such a wonderful daughter. And I really, really, my family just loves you. I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Happy anniversary. Thank you.
Okay.
For having
me. See you. Well, we'll get together as soon as we get over this.
Yes. Thing. After the quarantine, we'll get together and celebrate.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Then you can have some of my champagne. Okay.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you for calling in today. Thanks, Kanisha.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
Okay. Wow. I am very lucky today. Thanks. I have to thank Tan Talk Radio and Big Ed and Lola here at the studio, because I'm going to have an extended program today. I get 2 full hours. I could do this all the time. Do you realize that once I sit here behind the microphone, I can talk and talk and talk, and nobody... When I started this program 5 years ago, nobody would have believed it. I'm wearing a bright green jacket. I'm actually wearing the same clothes I had, except I'm not wearing my green stiletto heels because I just can't do it. I had a little bit of a problem with my ankle, but I'm wearing the same green, bright green, because I started on St. Patrick's Day. Today is St. Patrick's Day. It's a lucky day. Tuesday is a lucky day. And mostly, I just want to thank my family for being so wonderful. And my husband, of course, who I realized after once I started this program, that what I really owed him the most is that he did so much for me. He was always, really taking care of things like shopping and cooking, and that's why I could read so much. That's why I've read 10,000 books. That and with my boys homeschooling, that's what we did. We read, and so that's why I know so much about so many of the authors who have been on Joy on Paper. I tell you in this hour that remember that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And we're going to take a little break here and in a few minutes. And I just, again, want to thank Big Ed in the control room particularly. He is so wonderful. He's wearing a green shirt today. And I cannot express how wonderful this man is. And also, I want to thank Jim Lamb for sending out the press releases for this 5th anniversary program, because he also is a great friend of Joy on Paper and very just beloved by me and appreciated by all my family for the wonderful press releases that he sent out and that were picked up by so many newspapers this year. So a very, very big thank you to Jim Lamb and to Big Ed in the control room. And then we're going to have a break, and then we're going to come back and do another hour. And I have Hillary Davidson. My goodness, she has a great new book. And Mary Doria Russell about the Copper Country. Be back in 5 minutes. Okay. Bye-bye now.